Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Whitehaven Coal Limited's 2014 Annual General Meeting. My name is Mark Vaile. I'm the Chairman of the Whitehaven Board of Directors, and will be Chair of today's meeting. Declare there is a quorum present, and I formally declare the 2014 Annual General Meeting of Whitehaven shareholders open. It's my pleasure to welcome all shareholders and visitors to this year's meeting. Sitting at the table with me are your board and senior executive team. From my left, your right, is Tim Burt, who's the Company Secretary, Paul Flynn, our Managing Director and CEO, John Conde, Deputy Chairman of the Board and Chairman of the Audit and Risk Committee, Christine McLoughlin.
Is Oliver okay?
Rick Gazzard, Non-Executive Director, Tony Haggarty, Chairman of the Health, Safety, Environment and Community Committee.
He's safe.
Rob Sage, Director.
This is distortion on our end.
I think.
Okay.
Kevin Ball's on mute.
Into red.
Kevin Ball.
From our end.
Is the company CFO.
Would you be able to gain it on your end?
We'll begin today's meeting with my chairman's address, and then Paul Flynn will address the meeting before we get into the formal part of the meeting.
Okay.
With the four resolutions that are to be put before shareholders today.
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a challenging year for Whitehaven, and the coal industry in general. The environment for coal companies has been tough, with coal prices for all coal types declining during the year, while the Australian dollar remained strong despite falls in commodity prices. These tough market conditions have resulted in Whitehaven reporting a full-year loss in FY 2013. Notwithstanding these challenging market conditions, Whitehaven has delivered significant operational achievements and remains focused on our strategy to become the leading independent listed coal business in Australia. Despite the difficult conditions at present, shareholders have reason to be upbeat about Whitehaven's prospects over the long term. Maules Creek is only months away from generating significant cash, and within a few years, Whitehaven will be one of Australia's largest and lowest cost producers of high-quality coal. Meanwhile, global demand for coal in absolute tonnage terms continues to rise steadily. Australian exports are estimated to rise to 437 million tons by FY 2019, up from 336 million tons in FY 2013. Prices are forecast to have recovered significantly from present levels over this period. Ladies and gentlemen, coal is Australia's second-largest export commodity, and is the world's most reliable source of cost-effective energy, underpinning economic growth and increased standards of living in many countries around the globe. This is an important point, and one that many of the ideologically driven critics of coal seem to miss. We in the developed world have relied on coal to produce the products we now take for granted every day: cars, mobile phones, homes, the energy that powers those homes. It's not for us, the rich Western world, to deny people in developing nations access to affordable energy sources, which is the key to eliminating poverty. Over the longer term, coal will continue to play a critical role in the global energy mix and will likely remain the dominant source of energy around the world for the foreseeable future. Whitehaven's coal is clean and high in energy, low in trace elements, low ash, low sulfur, and low phosphorus. As the world moves towards cleaner sources of thermal coal, it will increasingly benefit both Whitehaven and Australia more generally. Despite a very challenging year for the coal industry, we have made significant progress toward our goal of transforming Whitehaven into one of Australia's largest independent coal producers. Supporting this is the development of our Maules Creek open cut mine near Gunnedah, the largest mine of its type being brought to market anywhere in Australia. Our team's management of the development of Maules Creek has been highly professional, and as we recently announced, first coal will be railed in January. The early delivery of coal represents a significant milestone that few construction projects have been able to achieve. All of this, despite the efforts of protesters and anti-coal zealots, the achievement reflects well on the tier 1 executive and management team we have assembled. which is clearly capable of establishing Whitehaven as a global industry leader. Capable of producing 12 million tonnes per annum of coal over 30 years, the Maules Creek mine confers a scale on Whitehaven that few of our peers in Australia could hope for. Moreover, it will be producing exactly the type of high energy coal, low in impurities, that our international customers are now specifying. It is increasingly obvious from the contact the board and senior management have had with their Asian markets that the global shift to cleaner, more efficient coal is underway and irreversible. Governments, including China, are responding to the environmental challenge and requiring their industries to source higher energy, higher quality coal. This plays to the strength of the Australian industry generally and Whitehaven in particular. Whitehaven already produces a high quality thermal product with low levels of ash, sulphur and phosphorus. Maules Creek will increase the proportion of higher value PCI coal and semi-soft coking coal used in steel making that we sell, giving us diversification in product exposure and enhanced flexibility in global markets. By repositioning Whitehaven further down the cost curve, Narrabri and Maules Creek also future-proof our company. When it is fully operational, our expected fully absorbed costs of coal sold will be less than $67 a tonne FOB, placing us in the lowest cost quartile among the Australian producers, strengthening our resilience to adverse industry conditions. Ladies and gentlemen, I referred earlier to the anti-coal protests that have taken place around the construction of Maules Creek. Whitehaven is acutely aware of the sensitivities to the development of the Maules Creek project. We believe we have addressed these sensitivities in the approval process for the project. Indeed, the conditions applied to this project are more stringent than any contemporary project. This commitment extends to the local region. While the so-called fly-in, fly-out protesters funded by major offshore activist groups have generated a fair amount of noise, Whitehaven has worked assiduously to involve the local townships of Narrabri, Gunnedah and Boggabri in this project. The benefits to these communities are already tangible in the form of jobs, services and investment during the construction stage. Once operational, the mine will deliver long-term employment and supply opportunities for services and consumables from local businesses. I'm very proud to report that more than 75% of our 650 plus employees live and work locally, where they and their families form a large part of the local community. This is good for those employees and their families, it's good for our company and it's good for the community. Ladies and gentlemen, Whitehaven takes our responsibility to working with local Aboriginal and Indigenous communities seriously. Over the past year, Whitehaven has worked with more than 190 registered Aboriginal parties, including members of the Gomeroi people. We've spent more than $5.4 million on various cultural heritage and conservation programs. The Maules Creek project is poised to deliver substantial socio-economic benefits to the Narrabri and Gunnedah regions and to New South Wales more broadly, through the creation of new jobs, local investment, export revenue, taxes and royalties. The voluntary planning agreement concluded with the Narrabri Shire Council has seen Whitehaven commit more than $13 million in local funding from mine revenues, including $6 million towards local road and infrastructure upgrades and $5 million towards the upgrade of the Narrabri Airport. Narrabri Council and the local community acknowledge the central role Maules Creek will play in shoring up the economic viability and sustainability of the region over the longer term. This project is good news for the local community and for the state and reflects the strong contribution that the industry continues to deliver. The success to date of the Maules Creek rollout reflects a growing momentum and confidence within Whitehaven as we capture the opportunities flowing from the merger with Ashton Resources that took place in 2012. A particularly pleasing aspect of FY 2014 has been the discipline with which management has reduced expenses, driven efficiencies and extracted the benefits of scale. Measures have included renegotiating rail and port charges on more favourable terms, centralising administrative functions in Newcastle and implementing a procurement strategy at the group level. Over the previous year, the company company's existing operations have performed strongly and reduced production costs. When this is coupled with productivity gains at the Narrabri longwall operation and Tarrawonga and Rockland mines, it is clear that strong progress has been made optimising Whitehaven's operating platform. The board's intention is that a lean cost base remains a permanent feature of Whitehaven's operations. These operational achievements take on added importance in light of external market conditions which continue to weigh on Whitehaven's financial performance. Amid continued softness in coal pricing and an unhelpful currency, a 25% increase in production to 10.3 million tonnes on a 100% basis translated to a 21.4% increase in revenue to $755.4 million in FY14. The net loss after tax narrowed to $38.4 million from $88.7 million the previous year. There was no dividend declared in FY2014 in line with current dividend policy. While these results are difficult for shareholders to accept, they reflect external conditions over which we have little or no control. From the board's perspective, the management imperative in such an environment is to tighten control over costs and productivity. Senior management deserves credit for the executing so well against this imperative. Importantly, Whitehaven's funding position remains healthy, with net debt as at the 30th of June standing at $685.2 million and gearing at a modest 18%. Remaining drawdowns on the senior debt facility is sufficient to complete the capex on Lulls Creek. Ladies and gentlemen, there have been some changes in the board during the course of the year. Philip Christensen, a former non-executive director, independent director, resigned as a director on the 14th of July. As chair of the Health and Safety, Environment and Community Committee, Philip had an important role shaping our community engagement and environmental strategies and driving the safety improvement agenda. We thank Philip for his contribution and wish him well in his future endeavours. Also during the year, we welcomed Kevin Ball to the ranks of the senior leadership team following his appointment as Chief Financial Officer in December of 2013. To further support our future growth, Whitehaven has also appointed a new Executive General Manager for Marketing. Scott Knights is with us today, sitting in the front row. And we've also opened a sales office in Japan, a key market for our Whitehaven products. Ladies and gentlemen, despite the difficult conditions at present, shareholders have reason to be upbeat about Whitehaven's prospect over the short and medium term. Maules Creek is only months away from railing first coal, and within a few years, Whitehaven will be one of Australia's largest and lowest cost producers of high quality coal. Meanwhile, global demand for coal in absolute tonnage terms continues to rise steadily. Australian exports are estimated to rise to 437 million tonnes in 2019, up from 336 million tonnes in 2013. And prices are forecast to have recovered significantly from present levels over this period. As a 23 million tonne producer, with pre-approvals in place at Vickery to expand to an additional 5 million tonnes per annum if required, Whitehaven is ideally placed to participate in this growth. Ladies and gentlemen, we are grateful for the role local communities have played in Whitehaven's success to date, and we do not take that support from those local communities for granted. In closing, can I say to all of our shareholders, thank you quite sincerely for your patient support of the company. Finally, I would like to take this opportunity to thank my colleagues on the board and the management team for their hard work and efforts during the past year. Can I also take this opportunity to extend my gratitude to Whitehaven's entire workforce for their contribution to the company in a challenging year. Our future is assured by the quality people that we have working at the coalface every day on behalf of shareholders. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That concludes my address. I'll now invite the Managing Director, Paul Flynn, to address the meeting.
Thank you, Chairman. And let me just add my welcome, if I could, to our shareholders here today, to the 2014 Whitehaven Coal Annual General Meeting. As your chairman has outlined, 2014 has been a year of challenges. With coal prices at five-year lows and our currency unhealthily high, all exporting businesses have experienced strong headwinds during this last period. That makes our journey as a company, I think, even more extraordinary. Our company is making an amazing transformation and is transitioning from a business which was dependent on smaller scale open corporations to a more diverse business characterised by two tier one assets in our Narrabri underground mine and our Moore Street open cut project. In doing so, we believe we're certainly creating the premier ASX listed coal company in Australia. With Narrabri just finishing its second full year of commercial production, we've certainly doubled the scale of the company in output from 5 million tonnes to 10 million tonnes in managed terms. With Maules Creek coming online, that's set to double again. In 3 years' time, we'll reduce, as Mark said, between 22 and 23 million tonnes in managed terms. This is an exciting transformation, which is significant in any company's history, but very significant given the context of the environment in which we're operating. As the chairman has noted, there are a bunch of external demands on the business which are outside of control, but management has worked tirelessly to manage what we can within the business. Included in those distractions have been the anti-coal activists. And the anti-coal activists will tell you that the future of coal is bleak. They are wrong. We know that there's several activists who come to the party today who bought shares, and I ask them to respect the wishes of those genuine shareholders who are here to hear about the prospects they're coming in 2014 and also the progress for 2015. But I think it's timely for us to reflect a little bit on the place of coal in the world. Coal is the cheapest, most reliable and lowest risk form of energy. From a capital cost perspective, it's also the cheapest to install per megawatt hour of capacity. It's also irreplaceable in the process of producing steel. Coal has enriched the Western nations of the world, and over the past 20 years has been the mainstay of the affordable energy supply that has allowed China to move 500 million people out of poverty. That's an extraordinary achievement, certainly unprecedented in human history. And whilst we're also reflecting on human history, we should also reflect on the fact that the very discovery of coal avoided the wholesale denuding of the planet of trees, where it was traditionally the primary source of fuel for heating and industry. Coal is energising the world. Our global population grows by 210,000 people per day. Coal is the dominant source that will actually allow them affordable access to electricity. And that's an aspiration for them as opposed to what we take for granted in our lives today. So let's not be so arrogant as to deny the very fuel that has allowed us to prosper and stand with you today. Approximately 85,000 people in China and India move into urban cities. And we all know that the transmission of people into urban cities is directly related to their consumption of electricity. Coal will be 70% of the needs, 70% of the needs for energy needs in both India and China. There are 1.1 million open accounts for the internet every day. I mean, that's a staggering number. And the electricity that's used in order to operate the World Wide Web is dependent on coal. There's 225,000 new cars produced every day. It takes 0.75 tonne of metallurgical coal in order to produce your average size. Now, a much smaller car than it used to be, family hatchback. Again, and that's even before you start considering the amount of electricity that's consumed in the manufacturing process itself. All this means is that on a daily basis, the world needs 21 million tonnes of coal, on a daily basis. The world has become more focused on consuming these fuels with less environmental impact. And as our chairman's noted, the world is evolving and regulatory frameworks are incentivising us to change as well. As a seller of the best quality and cleanest coal in the world, Australia is in a fantastic position to benefit from this trend. And Whitehaven, with its superior coal quality relative to the Australian average, will benefit disproportionately for that. So these numbers are staggering. These numbers are absolutely staggering. Other sources of fuel and energy and electricity will come to the market. There's no doubt about that. Renewables will take their place. But renewables are of an intermittent nature. And so the very nature of renewables demand that there is reliable, affordable coal, gas and nuclear baseload generation. With nearly 3.5 billion people in the world without any ready access to reliable electricity, the need for coal continues to grow. These graphs here would depict that there's 1.5 billion tonnes of extra production required over the next 20 years, which is a view consistently held with the International Energy Agency. The International Energy Agency also goes on to say that coal will be the single largest source of energy in 2035, a position it does hold today. The rapid growing countries and rises in the sustainable level of their growth even dictates that whilst overall percentage of growth will diminish, the physical tonnes in growth will be absolutely extraordinary. Now, it's not all about China, so if we focus a little bit on India, it is a time to reflect on their situation as well. There are 700 million people in India who do not have reliable access to electricity, and nor for that matter, a flushing toilet. As a rapidly growing country, India has acknowledged that 60% of those fuel needs to meet the needs of this population will come from coal. And in considering their broader needs in terms of the capital required to actually meet that energy demand, they've acknowledged that the cost of electricity coming from solar is six times the cost of that from coal. This graph here depicts the United Nations view that the relationship between affordable electricity and the quality of life is directly linked. The United Nations acknowledges that in order to move India and China from that position low on the curve through to anywhere near those of the developed world is an aspiration, but an aspiration which is only achievable with the availability of affordable electricity. So what's happening with electricity around the world? Well, the answer here is that technology is improving the consumption of coal and also reducing the emissions that come from it. From 1870 to 1940, the average temperature of the globe rose by 0.5 degree Fahrenheit, and over the following 70 years to 2010, increased another 0.5 degrees of Fahrenheit. Now, that's an extraordinary comparison when you consider these two periods. The industrialisation of the world over the last 70 years saw a disproportionate increase in the population and an exponential growth in emissions of CO2 over the previous 70 years. So how is it that the average climate of the world only increased by 0.5 over the subsequent 70 years? Absent nuclear power, there is no substitute for coal as a cornerstone provision of baseload energy generation. But technology is making this low-cost fuel even cleaner. As you can see on this slide, I think I've got a pointer here. If I put a few names to this slide just so everyone can see where they are. This is essentially Australia here, an average efficiency of about 38%. This is essentially Japan. So that movement here from here to here, already if you apply that across our Australian generation fleet, would also make a massive step change in terms of our reduction of emissions over time. And this is a very concrete and tangible step that is certainly capable within the world's power, without trashing the existing investment in all this generation capacity. But the real prize, I think, is moving even further down the curve. Coupling a closed cycle power generation with coal-fired electricity will certainly give you a massive step, but the real prize at the end of the day is carbon capture and storage. Now, lots of people say carbon capture and storage is a pie-in-the-sky type technology, but the reality is that it is actually functioning and it has been commercialised. Now, that will see a 90% reduction in the CO2 emissions from coal-fired generation and 100% reduction from the sulphur dioxide emissions from the same power source. Given its existing scale and the investment in existing coal-fired generation, I put it to you that coal may well be the only form of energy that could materially address the man-made contributions to climate change. So there's been much debate in our environment just about the place of coal and where it goes, and I thought it would be good to just reflect on what the body politic thinks about our place in our industry. It's very encouraging to see both political leaders on both sides of the divide supporting our industry openly and unreservedly. And they understand very well the critical place that mining and certainly coal places in the prosperity of Australia and the world. Prime Minister Tony Abbott has said, and I quote, "Energy is what sustains prosperity and coal in the world's eventual source, and it will be for many decades to come." He then went on to say, "Coal is good for humanity, coal is good for prosperity, coal is an essential part of the economic future here in Australia and right around the world." I think it's also worth remembering that those who oppose our industry and coal as a use of fuel going forward are scantily represented in the 150-strong seat government, where governments are formed in this country. This picture, I won't dwell on this too long, but just really just gives you a graphic of our projects and where we are. The Whitehaven is the largest single employer in the Gunnedah region, and we take that responsibility very seriously. As our chairman said, we employ about 75% of our workforce from the local area, and we're very proud of the fact that people go home from work to their families at the end of every day. That support that we feel from the community is broad-based, and both qualitative and quantitative surveying that we've done in the area certainly support that. This support was also evidenced when we opened the door for our first tranche of recruitment for Maules Creek, where we received over 1,800 applications for a job of the 100 positions that we had available within that first week. A very, very resounding vote of support for us. Tuesday a week ago, we also held a media day on site at Maules Creek, where we invited councillors from Gunnedah and Narrabri, the business changes from Narrabri and Gunnedah, various business leaders from the area, competing land users were also there, representatives of the Indigenous peoples were there as well, and it was good to see uniform support for what we're doing on the ground in the communities in which we're making a big difference. We pay $80 million in wages in 2014 to the people in the area, and those dollars reverberating around the streets of Gunnedah and Narrabri is very easy to see and very pleasing when you walk down the street and see business prospering and people's lives being enriched. As an organisation, we've totaled $25 million in voluntary planning agreements with the relevant councils to make our contribution to the necessary infrastructure in the area. And in addition to that, we've also made ad hoc donations through the year of $150,000 to worthy causes. In order to say we have a strong community engagement, we also need to ensure that we are actually speaking to the whole community. And that's very important to us. We understand that in the populations outside in Gunnedah and Narrabri, the local Indigenous people represent 8 to 9% of the population. And in order to address an imbalance in our business, where we feel this 8 to 9% is underrepresented in our business, we've set ourselves a target that we will recruit 10% of the workforce in Maules Creek in 5 years. And with our first wave of employment that was opening some months ago now, we certainly have exceeded that target. And we're very pleased with the result. And we're not doing it because we've been told to do it or because we've been regulated to do it. We're doing it because we believe it is the right thing for us to do. And that when we speak about the community and it benefiting from our presence there, the whole community should benefit from it. We've invested $5.4 million in the preservation of cultural heritage during the last 12 months, and we've worked with over 190 registered Aboriginal parties during the course of this period. Many people have worked tirelessly to help us conduct a very important cultural heritage salvage work on site, and we're very appreciative of that support, not just by the younger members of the community, but also the elders as well. To bolster our engagement with the community, we've also hired a Gomeroi man, Mr. Bob Sullivan, who's our Aboriginal Community Relationships Officer and has made a tremendous impact in the community and has been warmly welcomed by many of them. So the year that was in 2014 was firmly the belief that we should be setting targets and driving for the achievement of those. So I won't go through these in absolute detail, but I will say we've certainly achieved a record in terms of our safety performance. We don't consider more tonnes appropriate if we're not improving our safety at the same time. We've had production records at Tarrawonga, Werris Creek and Narrabri, of course, and our costs have been coming down at the same time, having been reduced by 9%. We've remedied the thermal coal energy balance at our Narrabri mine, and all coal that left the site was certainly capable of achieving benchmark for the better price. Werris Creek expansion was finished in December as promised, and Maules Creek, as our chairman has highlighted and we've announced recently, first coal will be about months away. Our banking syndicate has been extremely supportive of us, and we've realigned our covenants to reflect the time scheduled for first coal for Maules Creek. As our chairman mentioned, we've established an office in our key market in Japan, and we're able to entice a very well-respected coal marketing professional out of one of our major competitors to establish and run that office for us. To say our safety performance has been very, very good, but this is certainly a journey which is never over. Our numbers, our tripper rate was the lowest in 5 years, and we want to continue to see that trend downwards. I think this is vitally important when we're talking about a doubling of our coal production over the next 3 years. Some other key statistics, of course, in this difficult environment, recording a profit would be difficult for us, but certainly from a cash flow perspective or from an EBITDA perspective, the fourfold increase in our EBITDA has been a very solid achievement. In terms of operating cash flow, there's been a $140 million turnaround in 1 year to the next, and as I said, our costs have come down by 9%. Our gearing, as the chairman mentioned before, is modest at 18%. But this has been a very difficult challenge in this environment with the same price and FX being unhelpful during this time. The story for all mining companies, as you would imagine at this time, is reducing costs, and we've certainly been not immune to that. I think we've been very effective in reducing our costs overall, and you can see the pathway of the half years over the last four half years, looking at the trend downwards in our costs. At $67, we think there's further potential yet to decrease those costs further, and we've given guidance saying that we'll do at least a couple more dollars in this new financial year. And the important thing to note is that these are not short-term measures, these are sustainable cost reductions that we can continue to operate within our business over time. When you review where our coal is going, our business is also changing, not just in total output, but also in mix of product. The premium markets of Japan, Korea and India are very important to us, although we do acknowledge that China will be a market for us in the future. Today, we have a minimal amount of our coal which goes to China, and given the recent announcements in China restricting coal qualities, this is supportive of the notion that we say, over time, governments will regulate, and demand for cleaner coal will actually be more and more crucial. That's certainly the path that Japan has chosen, Korea has chosen, and we see China taking that same route as well. And just to be clear, all the coal produced by Whitehaven is superior to the quality thresholds demanded by China as announced a month or so ago. So as I say, our product split will be changing from thermal to semi-soft. Our ratio today is 80% thermal, 20% semi-soft PCI. With Maules Creek in full flight, that ratio will change from 60% thermal to 40% metallurgical NPCI. As we know, government regulation continues to change and the global environment will continue to do that. But our low ash, low sulphur, low phosphorus, coupled with our high calorific value, will be the go-to coal for the future. We've recorded also record sales during the course of the year, and obviously Narrabri has been a cornerstone of that achievement, allowing us to improve by 26% to 10.3 million tonnes for the year. All operations have performed well, I think, which is quite a staggering feat. We've not only been able to build Maules Creek on time on budget, but our open cut and underground operations have all performed very, very well. Narrabri, as you know, is a Tier 1 asset and going from strength to strength. In 2 short years since it was commercially commissioned, this mine is now probably in the top 3 longwalls in the country and really setting new standards for us and the industry. The 5.7 million tonnes of ROM produced in the year was a fantastic achievement. Not only is our benchmark thermal product well sought after, but our PCI quality is also gaining strong penetration within the marketplace. The horizon control issues that we saw at stoppage in April have been resolved, and we think that underpins now our guidance that we will exceed more than 6.5 million tonnes in the FY15 year. Critical to any longwall operation is obviously the development work, and in our instance we maintain fantastic float in order to ensure that there's continuity of our production at all times. In more recent months we've been doing over 2,000 metres per month, which certainly would put us at the top of the class, I think, in terms of longwall mining in Australia. But as we examine the options to how to optimise Narrabri, we've considered top coal caving, as you know, and recently announced that is not the path for us going forward. There is a superior option in the broadening of our face from 300 metres to 400 metres, which will see a number of big improvements for the mine. And just to go through a couple of the highlights for us in terms of what we believe a 400 metre wide face would represent for the Narrabri mine. We would be able to avoid about 60 kilometres of roadway development during the course of the life of mine. We would see a $3 to $4 per tonne reduction in costs, and we would see 700 to 800,000 tonnes of production increments on a per annum basis. Certainly a compelling proposition. The other bookend, if you like, of our Tier 1 portfolio was Maules Creek, which is now well ahead of schedule, as you know, and certainly on budget. The backdrop of time delays and cost blowouts that you've seen in the industry certainly haven't affected us, and that really is a standout in our industry. At $64 per tonne of installed annual capacity, our construction of Maules Creek is one of the cheapest installations of a high-quality asset that you'll see in this country. At this slide, you can certainly see we're ahead of schedule, and as I say, we're looking for production now to be railed in January of 2015. The construction team has done an extraordinary job, given all the circumstances that they have confronted in these difficult times. And that difficult times has also included both unwanted and unwarranted detention on site of the protest activity that's been continuing there. So just to be clear also on Maules Creek and what the environment in which we're building this. Maules Creek is constructed in an area which has been intensively logged for the last 40 years by New South Wales state government. It is not the pristine forest that people would have you believe. This area has been heavily, heavily denuded over time, and when people visit the site, they can see the scale of the trees there really represent regrowth. This is not the pristine forest that people have been believing. I know it's not in people's interest to tell you that, but that is the case. The protester group, as our chairman has highlighted, are largely fly-in, fly-out. They don't represent the sentiment of the people at large in the community. And at some point they're going to have to accept the umpire's decision and move on. On the mining front, there are several important milestones have also been achieved during the course of the 12 months, and certainly the initiation of the box cut in August 2014 was part of that. We truly believe that operating this mine ourselves is certainly the way to go, and as a result of being able to procure exactly the equipment we need that suits the rate of production that we require from the outset. We've also been able to reduce the capital costs associated with that, and then also procure very attractive financing in the form of leasing, operating leasing, so that we haven't deployed any of our own capital in order to get that equipment. Now, we've done it cheaply, there's no doubt about it, but we're not compromising the OPEX cost of the operation by doing that either. Our expectation for the thermal coal product on an FOB basis is between $62 and $64, and we expect that metallurgical coal and the PCI that we produce will be about $3 to $4 more than that. This will ensure that the premium products we produce, not just the thermal coal, the premium products we produce, will be in demand and will be profitable right throughout the cycle. I thought I'd throw in a few pictures here just to explain to you some of the changes that are occurring at the site, because it does change very, very quickly. So you can see here we're basically looking from the top of the ROM hill where we produce the coal. It's loaded into a hopper, and this is the conveyor stations and transfer points that go along to the train loadout pin. You'll see here, you've seen there, that loop around there is actually the rail loop itself. The trains come in under here and exit to the left of the screen. The rate of progress, as I say here, has been absolutely fantastic, and it's a credit to our team that have been able to maintain their focus with all the distractions to be able to achieve what is an outstanding installation in this industry. There, basically, you can see the rail line coming in, the sweeps have been laid out, and they're busily welding up sections of rail as we speak. Okay, this is another perspective on the train line out here, but this is also our stockyards will go two parallel stockyards about here and here, with our stacker reclaimer systems built in the new parallel. The Vickery project. Well, in September we're very, very pleased to be able to kick another goal and bring the Vickery project through the approval system. Our system, as we all know, has been fraught, and certainly the Maules Creek experience made us a little gun-shy. We have now in our hands an approved project which has a large-scale, high-quality resource that is as good a quality as Maules Creek, if not even better. The approval allows us to truck at 4.5 million tonnes per annum down to our existing Gunnedah prep plant. And as the 100% owner of this asset, we are now looking to forming a joint venture around this project. Given that there's no need to build a rail line and no need to build a prep plant, the capex required to bring this project online is minimal. From a timing perspective, we see this coming to the fore after Maules Creek is running at its full 13 million tonne per annum run rate. As an investment proposition, we think Whitehaven is compelling. Lots of mining companies have hockey sticks in their promotional slide decks. And we're no different, we've got one of those as well. But the difference with ours is that it is real. The doubling of our company over the last 3 years, you can see, the green section, that has already been done. We're about to see this in the space of 3 months, being the first contribution of coal from Maules Creek. So our hockey stick is real, unlike some of those people who will throw away hockey sticks as a promotional tool. Maules Creek, Narrabri and Werris Creek will ensure that Whitehaven remains a low-cost producer and will push us into the lowest cost quartile once Maules Creek is up and running. The Vickery project represents a significant expansion opportunity for us also, and as I said, with its low cost profile for opening up, we're talking in the tens of millions, not hundreds of millions, in order to bring 4.5 million tonnes of capacity online. So I might just finish where we started. We truly believe that setting targets and focusing on them is the way to get through these difficult times. We set a number of targets for ourselves in 2014, and we largely achieved those. Well, certainly everything that was in our control, I think we have. Our areas of focus for the new year will see us drive safety even further. Maules Creek, as you know, will come in January 2015, and it will be under budget. We will place our quality coal in the hands of the right customers for the right price. We're very proud of the relationship we have with the local community, and we seek to deepen that even further in this year. We'll drive efficiency and cost reductions right through our business in accordance with the path we set for ourselves during 2014. And we'll put in place a funding plan that's reflective of our needs as we turn away from the construction phase into the operation phase. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. We believe in the future of coal, and we believe in the future of Whitehaven. We do believe that we're creating the premier ASX-listed company in the country. and we thank you very much for your rigorous and resolute support in 2014 and look forward to performing for you in 2015. Thank you. Thanks very much, Paul, for that comprehensive report on behalf of the management team for the activities of the last 12 months and the projections moving forward. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we'll move on to the formal business of the meeting. I just want to briefly move on some of the procedural issues that we need to be cognizant of. Firstly, unless there is any objection, I'll take the notice of the meeting as read. This year, again, we are using an electronic voting system which enables votes on each resolution to be recorded and reported to you quickly and accurately. As a result, we'll be determining all resolutions at this meeting by way of poll. Shareholders will be provided with a reasonable opportunity to ask questions as we progress through the items on the agenda for today's meeting. Your electronic handsets will operate as a microphone when you're asking a question. Shareholders with questions relating to specific resolutions are requested to ask those questions when we are considering that resolution. Any general questions should be asked at the time we consider financial reports. I ask you to limit your questions to ensure that as many shareholders as possible have an opportunity to ask questions. I would also like to remind everyone in the room to be respectful to all shareholders who have taken the time to attend the AGM today. We welcome your questions and comments, but obviously anybody who's offensive or disruptive will be requested to leave the meeting and allow other shareholders the opportunity to have interaction with the management team. If there are media present in the room today, you're more than welcome to observe proceedings. I would ask, however, that all attendees refrain from using photographic or digital recording equipment. Once the AGM is concluded, there will be an opportunity for members of the media to put any questions they have to myself or the CEO. I'm going to now hand over to Lusaka Martin to provide shareholders with instructions and a bit of guidance on how to use the electronic handsets that you've been given when you registered. Lusaka.
To vote on a resolution, when the resolution comes up, screen share the handset will show for, against, or abstain. You then just select one for four, two for against, or three for abstain on the handset. That'll happen when the chair calls the poll open. The chair will then just give you a warning to close the poll. Second thing, because the handsets are going to be used as your microphone today, if you wish to ask a question, all you need to do is press the microphone key on your handset and you will go in the queue to be asked a question. The chairman will then call out your name or the question. Handset will become a microphone to ask a question. When you're asking a question, please
stand close to the handset so lift it up to your mouth so everyone in the room can hear your question. That covers off how to use the handset. Okay, Ms. Sasaka. Okay, the first item that we're going to do with this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is the financial reports. So the financial reports are reports of the directors and the auditor for the year ended 30th of June 2014 have been made available. The Corporation Act requires that these reports be laid before the meeting. However, there is no requirement for the shareholders to vote on these reports. Trent Van Veen, a partner of Ernst & Young, Whitehaven's auditor, is here today to answer questions on the... Where's Trent? Here he is. Welcome, Trent. Trent's here today to answer any questions on the audit and content and preparation of the audit report,
Trent, would you, I understand. So we move to the first item of discussion, the financial reports, before the meeting, and ladies and gentlemen, the matter is now open for discussion. If you would like to ask a question, please use your electronic handset to indicate that you want to ask a question, and we'll go through those queued questions and provide everybody with the opportunity to ask a question. Okay, first we've got Mrs. Joy Llewellyn-Smith. It would be helpful. Yeah. Sorry, my housekeeping instructions at the start, I didn't get to. Now, you need to use your handset as your microphone.
This is
going to
be complicated for me.
I think it's on, isn't it? So if you just speak into it, yeah, it's on. Yep.
Now I've got to look at my notes. Welcome, everybody, and I hope we can have a really good interaction constructively. I could have taken offence, but I am a shareholder, and I've hung in here all through the development phase, and I've spoken after meetings with Tony and John, and I am here as your guardian angel, because you're getting a bit too locked into being defensive, and so you've taken an eye off the ball on strategy. So, I'll just have to ad-lib because I can't hold the paper and keep this at my mouth. Japan and Korea, good marketplaces for this company. I wasn't being flippant, but on the way in I did speak to somebody. But before Tim, somebody that actually isn't up on the board, but is a treasurer. I said, I didn't know you had treasurers in this company, but there he is. That's the man. So he knows the question, and it is to do with, and I do hold shares in other resource companies. I am a human geographer with a background in economics, and I'm a socio-economic researcher. And I do it these days for the universe. And I even give it my services to companies if I'm a shareholder, because it might pay off one day and I might get a dividend. So the question related to, we were called to an extraordinary meeting in September 2007 in Melbourne. It was Chairman Paul Skinner's last meeting with Rio Tinto. And he put that company into a very perilous position, because he got 97% of those in the meeting to approve a debt bigger than that of the federal government, so that they could buy the Hydro Alcan or Alcoa in Canada, because he had done his own strategy work, and he was convinced that in the future cars couldn't possibly be built from what they're built from today, because they'll have to be lightweight and energy efficient, and there you go. So I said to the treasurer, what other markets have we, the Whitehaven shareholders, got? And he said, well, we might be able to build some high-rise buildings, and I might have mentioned it to Tim as well. So I would like to hear from the board some of this strategic discussions, and share it with us, the shareholders, as to where we go, not in the short term, but the medium and the long term. And by long term, I mean more than 5 years. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mrs. Llewellyn-Smith. I could get Paul Vernon to repeat his answer to you if I'd like. I'll make a few comments, and I'll ask Paul to comment as well. Presumably you're talking about, you know, the markets today, the markets for the future, with the growth that we're projecting in production that is being underpinned by the debt that we are putting into investing in new projects, with your reference to the level of debt that Rio took on, ironically, that particular circumstance and the level of debt that Rio took on at the time actually gave rise to them having to divest themselves of some assets, and one of which was Maules Creek, that one of the predecessor companies of this one actually purchased from Rio. As Paul outlined, our major markets obviously are in North Asia. We've got a growing small exposure to China. It's less than 10% of our production. We have an increasing exposure to India, mostly in metallurgical coal, PCI contracts with India. And the growth is going to take place, we believe, and Paul can elaborate on this, is to an extent the move globally into higher quality, less emitting coals, coals that are under the 13% ash, coals that are less than 1% sulphur, coals that are emitting less CO2, that are less phosphorus in them. And so it's the quality of our product that's going to help gain an expanded market share in those major markets of the world. And we've already got that experience if you look at the standards that Paul alluded to that exist in Japan. They're actually higher standards than Australia in terms of the production of electricity using fossil fuels. And so as China moves through its evolutionary development phase, it's going to do, and it started to move to higher quality product. So there's a physical expansion with increasing demands coming out of countries like India, but also the step up and the change in demands in product from traditional markets like Japan and Korea and China as well. If Paul, do you want to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, look, I haven't got a lot to add. I wasn't quite sure, sorry, Mr. Norman Smith, of whether or not the question was debt-related, as the Chairman has attempted to cover off, or whether it was diversification, potentially, that you were referring to by referring to that particular excursion into an area that Rio wasn't in at the time. Yes. Oh, okay. Right. Well, certainly our current plans are that we are a coal company. We have a unique position, as I mentioned before, in the coal company spectrum in the world. We are very uniquely positioned as a mid-tier coal company that has essentially the command of the only high-quality coal basin emerging, certainly in this country. And as we know, the world is starved for quality coal. There is plenty of poorer quality coal washing around. Our position is uniquely positioned as the cornerstone provider of the cleanest coal in this country. So the question for us is really, is that the right path for us? And we're certainly firmly of the view that that is the place for us. We can see regulatory frameworks converging over time, driving individual jurisdictions offshore, and we are an exporter of essentially 100% of our product, to procure better quality coal to mix with the poorer quality coal that we're currently using. And that momentum will continue to gain pace, as it has with Korea only 3-4 months ago. A new regulatory framework has been brought in, and then China obviously taken a step in that direction also. The question of diversification at some point in the future is, I think, a question that the board will turn its mind to over time as we bed down some of our major projects currently.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul,
do
you want
to? Yeah, you're on. Okay. This is a language problem. So when I say diversification, I don't mean, but I think you've raised a really interesting long-term maybe diversification, or you fold the company because you don't want to diversify. My question was, if the world, in its striving to be more energy efficient and more people having cars, etc., if Paul Skinner turns out to be right, and his timing of his decision was wrong, then what percentage of Whitehaven's customers' use of our coal is tied up with motor vehicles? I notice it's Japan and Korea are the key marketplaces. What are they using the coal that we sell them to produce? Thank you.
Continue on, Mr. Chairman. As I say, 80% of our production at the moment goes into thermal generation. So in all those jurisdictions that you mentioned where we're selling coal, about 20% of our production now goes into steel making. And so in terms of its exposure to the production of motor vehicles, say for instance, whilst we're not directly exposed, we are indirectly exposed. The statistic I'll throw up there earlier on, which just says that there's about 750 kilograms, 3/4 of a ton, of metallurgical coal goes into the manufacture of a small motor vehicle of 1.3 tons in weight. So if you said that motor vehicles in the future are going to transition to, let's just say, aluminium, say for instance, to continue your line of thinking, then you can say that metallurgical coal might be used less for the production of steel as it relates to motor vehicle construction, but there's not too many other substitutes at the moment that we can see that says that the world is not going to continue to use a hell of a lot of steel, not just for car manufacture, but obviously as these developing nations continue to industrialise and urbanise, the demand for steel is going to go on for a long time to come.
Is going into producing steel that goes into cars. What's the 80%?
Power generation. That's correct.
So would we strategically be wondering what's going to happen with solar panels in developing countries and how that would affect the demand for coal?
I think we think about that a lot. There's no doubt about that. Not just solar, but wind also, wave and other forms of renewable energy. But the point with those technologies is that they are not sufficient to be able to sustain our civilised society for our baseload generation needs.
So if it was thermal coming from the rocks in the earth, geothermal, that would overcome...
Well, I think it will play its part in the future as well, as all these renewable sources will.
So
I've got a list of people here.
And guess what? I want to have the members of this board, if they're so confident, eyeballing the people sitting back here, because it was, I can tell you there were two that would eyeball me before. Now, past, present, future, they'll be coming.
Thank you, Mrs. Llewellyn-Smith. The next on my list is Nicholas Clyde.
So I'll be succinct with my question, but before I get to that, I just wanted to mention that I work for Greenpeace. We did launch a report this morning.
You've had your media event. Can you ask your question, please?
If anyone can talk to him, happy to chat.
Okay,
so my question is, my company, Greenpeace, is a shareholder in this company, Whitehaven Coal. With respect to Maules Creek and the plans to develop Vickery to 5 million tonnes a year, I'm just wondering how you guys, as the board, can assure shareholders, rather, that history will repeat itself, delivering another coal boom instead of structural decline of coal. So, and I refer to a report launched in New York recently, which suggests that thermal coal demand in China could peak between now and 2016, which, in the words of one analyst, would, quote, permanently alter the dynamics of the seaborne coal market. And in closing, I just note that the UN's chief climate negotiator says unabated coal has no future. As a pure-play coal company that we're invested in, how are you guys managing the risk of a structural decline? And if Whitehaven does want to stay into the Indie Energy business into the future, is it really time for you guys to start developing clean energy projects instead?
Thanks, Nicholas, for the question. Given the commitment in terms of investment in new assets and broadening out the asset suite that this company holds, the board and the management team, indeed the shareholders, do have confidence in the future of this industry. And I respect the report that you've been referring to there. I'll get Paul to refer to some of the statistics that he was using from the IEA as well. But I go back to my earlier point in terms of the changing marketplace, and there is a changing marketplace, and most recently we've seen those changes take place in China, where there is an acceptance of the fact that overnight we cannot switch off the generation of electricity through the use of fossil fuels, but we can continue to improve the use of those fossil fuels, we can continue to improve the quality of the inputs into that process as they move towards you know, addressing the broader issues of climate change. And so, and you know, in my comments and in the Managing Director's comments, we want shareholders and the market to be very cognizant of the products, the suite of products that we have in the assets we have. I mean, the investment rationale behind buying Maules Creek when Rio Tinto sold it in 2009 was because of the high energy, low ash, low impurities in that product. And because the balance of that product, you know, we can almost swing, if the market's there, the semi-soft metallurgical coal, you can swing the majority of the production out of that particular asset in a metallurgical coal, into steel making. It's not always going to be reliant on thermal coal markets. So you've got high quality, low impurity thermal coal and a lower cost metallurgical steel making coal, which is going to be continue to be in demand. I'll just click to Paul if you can make some comments on forecasting the IEA.
Forecast from the IEA says, as I say, coal will continue to be the single largest provider of energy in 2035. Now, those numbers are not ours. It's a well-recognised United Nations support institution, and we'll take on face value what it is that they say. We also think that they also recognise, in fact, they've explicitly said this, that carbon capture and storage, they do believe, is the key to sustaining the place of coal in the future. And that are their words, not ours. So if you look at the examples that we put up there in terms of the improvement in efficiency of using fossil fuels, and coal in particular, you can drive up to a 90% reduction in CO2. So, and if you can do that commercially, then why would anyone have an issue with coal going forward in the future? I think that's, the emissions would be so low as to make it very compelling as compared to any other form of base load generation you could possibly imagine.
Thanks, Paul. Okay, next question I've got is from Graham Brophy.
Am I on air?
Yeah, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've got a great product in both the metallurgical and the thermal coal, and that's terrific. I think the board have really engaged with the communities of Gunnedah and Werris Creek, etc., and Narrabri, and I think that's another great thing. What sort of worries me is the transportation end. I think we're probably hauling coal the largest distance of any other producer in New South Wales. And when you go to rural New South Wales, you see a lot of the branch railway lines in a very poor state of repair, particularly with some of the grade lines. And so I see transport as a big issue for the company. If we're increasing our volumes, as it looks as though we are, we have to make sure that the rail track is going to stand up to the added weights of coal that travel over it. So my question is, have we sort of got that covered? Are we, I think the body is involved with the Australian Rail Track Corporation, and they've got a bad record in some areas in the States, particularly between Albury and Melbourne. But have they got it covered? Are those lines going to be able to, particularly the lines north of Muswellbrook, are they going to be able to carry the increased production? That's my question.
It is a very good question. Obviously, in the development of a significant asset like this, you know, it's critical. I mean, if you haven't got the transport infrastructure to get from the producing entity to the port for export, you don't have a business, and that's exactly right. The Australian Rail Track Corporation does, as part of its network, completely managed the Hunter Valley coal line, and that now includes that section that goes right out to Wagga. Sadly, you're right, beyond that into the pastoral or the grain growing districts of northwestern New South Wales and up into Queensland, the condition of the line is probably not as good because they're running a business and they invest where they can get an economic outcome, an economic benefit. Going back a few years, I think that it was probably questionable as to whether the capacity of that line was enough, and I recall that when Tony Haggerty was running the former Whitehaven company and initially starting up some of the operations in the Gunnedah Basin, there had to be a commitment to the upgrade of some of those lines, and there was actually, you know, I think there might have been some direct funding at the time for some aspects of passing loops and improvements. In later years, because of the capacity, because of take or pay arrangements, where producers, whether you use your allocated capacity or not, you've got to pay for it, because the ART is making capital investments in upgrading the infrastructure. We've seen significant improvements with passing lifts, up over the other side of the Liverpool Range in the Gunnedah Basin, and down in the Hunter Valley where the traffic does get quite heavy. And so I think that they can always do more, but it's certainly improved in recent years in terms of, and it's really it's an allocation of capital where companies like ours are paying our access regime to the ARTC, and that funding is going directly into upgrading the infrastructure. And hopefully in the years to come it will improve significantly from where it is, but it is certainly satisfactory for us and our team in terms of managing the logistical operation of those the train sets running to and from the port, particularly over the Liverpool Range. And you've got passing lifts there, you've got a siding at where's the siding where the vent locator is, where we've actually got the extra locomotives that actually got to move the trains over the Liverpool Range and go down in the Hunter Valley. It is obviously an issue that we constantly monitor and work very closely with the ARTC. But it is one of the better run aspects of ARTC's business is actually the Hunter Valley Coal Line compared to some of those other relatives that you referred to. Now, the next question is from Tafui Nafu. Have I got that back to front?
Tafui Nafu.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. 2 weeks ago, I settled alongside 250 others into the back of coal ships in Newcastle Port. I was born on a traditional family in Mobile in my area. We, the Pacific Climate Warriors and our Australian supporters, took this action to highlight the link between Australian coal and climate destruction in our homeland. The movement for shift away from dirty fossil fuels is growing rapidly. Major institutions are divesting from the sector. Rural communities are locking their gates to new projects. And hundreds of thousands of people are marching on the streets around the world. Has Whitehaven calculated the cost today and future cost of this mining opposition?
Look, we're certainly very cognizant of the issue you raised more generally with climate change and what needs to be done. And we continue to repeat our perspective on that in terms of there's not an overnight crash through response to this. I mean, just the abolition and the demonisation of the coal industry is not the absolute response. The gradual movement towards the elimination of the use of much dirtier products than ours, I'm talking about Australian products. I mean, you can't generalise about the global coal industry. I mean, there are, I don't pretend to understand the different qualities and types of coal. I do know that the product that we produce is much, much cleaner, much more efficient, and an improvement in terms of environmental impact than many other products that are being used across the world. So the first stage in this process has got to be able to step up in the use of better quality products. I'm sure that for the newer homeland there's a significant deployment already of renewable energy sources, but I would presume, and I'm happy for you to answer on this, presume that in conjunction with that there is still a significant deployment of diesel generation for electricity, which is another area that needs to be managed. But the reality is, and I used to be involved in a renewable energy company, is that you do need alternatives to renewables to provide baseload and backup support in electricity generation systems. We understand and empathise with the circumstances of many of the Pacific Islanders, and we have a particular view of how that can be addressed responsibly moving forward over time. My next question is from John Saunders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We understand the benefits brought by employment and to the local communities, but just out of interest, what contribution do we make to the public purse by way of royalties?
Where's our treasurer? No, where's our CFO? Paul, you like that figure on the 50 terms? the contribution to the public purse from operations? Just purely royalties, sorry, purely royalties or?
Yeah, purely royalties. $7 million in the last financial year, Kevin, is that right?
It's about 8% of the revenue.
Yeah.
So it's 750.
Yeah. And over the life of Moores Creek, say, for instance, there'll be over $2 billion in royalties paid over the life of Moores Creek, which is obviously a significant contribution, as I say, as a function of rate that Kevin's just highlighted, but also the fact that it's got such a long life. The benefit to the state and therefore its contributions to its coffers and how that redistributes it, particularly we hope back in the region, that's a significant contribution for any particular asset to make.
Okay, thanks Paul. Our next question is from Mr. Steve Talbot.
Yeah, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and elders past and present of the land we're on today. My question to Whitehaven is, I've got stuff here that I've written down, but I'll get straight to the point. Most mining companies globally have signed on to the United Nations Human Rights Compact. We know Whitehaven are not on the ground that we lived and experienced. They haven't signed on to human rights. And where is it? Whitehaven promote themselves as committed to Aboriginal people yet divide communities and only work with a few local and target people out from outside the local and immediate area and have little knowledge or of the area that you're mining or the importance of Laird's Forest. Given your adverse impact on Gummeroi people and elders on our culture and areas, when and will you be signing on to the United Nations Human Rights Compact? And if not, why not? And given an AGM is to inform your investors of active complaints lodged against you by us, 181 traditional owners and also elders against violations against Whitehaven in regards to various retirees arrest, the FA cultural discrimination that has come before the discrimination. Just in regards to some of the cultural heritage stuff that we're talking about up there, I mean, I'll wait for the answer to the question, but if any of the shareholders want to talk to me in regards to Aboriginal cultural heritage, I'd love them for them to get in touch with me because I'd like to inform them of the rural impacts and what the impacts are up on our elders and the traditional owners of the Gummeroi.
Well, Steve, I'm sure there'll be an opportunity afterwards outside if anybody wants to talk to you about that, they can. I'll get, from an operational perspective, I'll get Paul to make some comments in a second, but with regard to the UN treaties. I mean, you know, we're an Australian company, we're part of the Australian nation, we're Australian citizens. Our government is a sovereign nation, is a signatory to those conventions. And so, if so, in fact, we are part of that, but I mean, and we observe those, we observe the rule of law in this land and those international conventions. But I might, just on some of the operations stuff, want to make a comment, Paul?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I say, we've invested substantially over a period of time, Stephen, I'm sure you'll understand, having been there and participated yourself actually on the ground during that time. So, as I say, over $5 million of investment from us in the preservation of cultural heritage. Now, we certainly don't profess to be knowledge holders in any way, as you know. We seek to engage with the knowledge holders on the ground and solicit their support, and they're important there. Their knowledge to contribute to each of the processes that we undertake on the ground. And in doing so, as you well know, we've worked with 190-odd registered Aboriginal parties during that time, and I know you've participated in salvage yourself. At all times, the work that we conduct there, we certainly don't conduct on our own. We conduct with the support of knowledge holders, where potential for particularly culturally sensitive areas have been identified. We brought the best of science to bear on each of those occasions, and certainly brought the findings from that to the government, and the government has used their experts to conclude
that in each of those potential areas, none of them have deemed to be cultural in any way, and that is a position that those experts have formed, that is a position that the government has concurred with, and I know that position has been written to the people that you're representing as a subset of the whole of the Ngāi people in the area. So,
thanks, Paul. The next question I have from Suniana Martin.
Thanks, Chairman. Weeks ago, I visited Mullis Creek coal mine project with 29 fellow Pacific sisters and brothers. It was confronting to see the destruction of the country and the division of the community and trashing of the cultural sites. In that I could see my own home, the sea level rising and the climate changes, we are losing the very land and the sources of food and the cultural spaces that define our culture. Say my homeland, I think it will require at least 80% of known fossil fuel reserve in the country and in the crowd. How does White Haven respond to the cause of the Pacific and the role in the fuel of
Thank you. I think some of my earlier comments may have addressed part of that. In terms of our view, in terms of the step change that needs to take place in recognising climate change in a responsible, balanced way in terms of the global economy. And some of those steps can be quite effective and quite efficient. I've made that comment. You want to just add to that, Paul, in terms of...
Yeah, I'm happy to. Look, our perspective is, as I say, we look at the installed coal-fired generation capacity around the globe, and it varies in countries such as our own, from 60-70% through to India and China and so on. And there's no doubt we all acknowledge that that the burning of coal does give rise to greenhouse gas emissions. There's no doubt about that. But we actually think that the coal that we produce, and given the clean nature of it, the low impurities nature of it, is the very solution that people should be turning to provide a practical reduction in CO2 emissions based on the investments that people have in coal-fired generation already. The chart that I showed you before there, which is acknowledged by the International Energy Agency, shows that the quality of coal we produce are the very ones that can be delivered into the ultra-supercritical boilers that are needed in order to drive lower emissions from coal usage. So for us, we actually would encourage the rest of the world to get on board, because we can see very meaningful reductions in emissions coming from the consumption of our coal. Say, for instance, Japan has already taken that journey and is the primary market for us in selling our coal. The Australian generation fleet its own is less efficient than the market we sell our coal to now. So our emissions as Australia, even though this resource comes from Japan, illogically is not consumed, whereas Japan obviously pays the premium for that quality coal. Now, it does come back to a question of ability to pay, we understand that. And Japan has set up a profile of regulation in their country which incentivizes people to pay a little bit more to produce less emissions. And we do see that as the answer. If you're not going to, as the chairman says, immediately trash the investment that everyone has made in coal-fired generation in the past, it needs to improve the emissions that come from coal-fired generation.
Thanks, Paul. Next question I have on my list is from Theresa Romero.
Among faith-based organisations, divesting from fossil fuels is an expression of a long frustrated desire for effective action to curb climate change. One after another, we are inspired to embrace this opportunity to stand with our brothers and sisters in the developing world and to stand with our children and grandchildren for a safer future. With regard to Whitehaven in particular, we also want to stand with the Gomeroi traditional custodians who, in spite of what has been said today, whose spiritual practices have been needlessly trampled by this company. what role do you believe these critical areas of ethics should play in conducting your business when all the experts are saying we must resolutely and rapidly move away from coal and resolutely and rapidly embrace renewable?
I don't necessarily accept the last part of your assertion that all experts say that. There is still a very important debate on about, not so much about climate change, but about, you know, what to do with it and who are the worst contributors. But I mean, everybody's entitled to that point of view. Also, on behalf of the company, I don't necessarily accept the assertion that we have trashed the rights of the traditional owners in the area. I've heard from Steve, but if we want to have that debate, we can bring the broader group from the community. We'll have a debate about that, because this company has worked assiduously and tirelessly to respect and work with the local Indigenous community. Sometimes to the point of frustration, because there are different points of view within that community as well. So I just wanted to make that point first, and again, operationally, let's get all the major points.
Thank you for the question. We certainly don't accept the notion that all the experts are of the union expressed. Perhaps the one that there'd be some subsection of the university experts which would be consistent with what you described. We certainly don't accept the notion either that we've been done anything to denigrate in any way anything cultural on the ground in Moores Creek. And as I say, we've invested substantially in verifying the existence of, or not, of anything cultural in the area that we've disturbed. That science has, as I say, proven that there is not. And we find ourselves in the interesting situation where, unfortunately, for those who have an opposing view, we can't ignore the science. Others might be different, but that just moves into a different area of police rather than actual science. As I say, we've certainly brought the best of science to site. Those views have been concurred with by the state government. They have written to the respective people interested to confirm that, having reviewed those findings, they confirm also that those sites are not helpful. But over time, we'll certainly want to work with the local people and make sure that their right of access is continues in the future, and that as I say, to deal with the more intangible elements, if you like, of cultural heritage, would be something that we would see as being cooperative in the future for us to work with the development people. I'll make one further comment, and not seeking to draw any parallels at all between the good work that obviously religious groups are doing, not just here in this country, but obviously for people in less fortunate circumstances around the world. We certainly do see, and we have seen, history has shown us, that the availability of affordable fuel is absolutely the fastest way to lift people out of their impoverished circumstances. And given the profile of the product that we produce, the clean nature of it relative to existing historical fossil fuels, we see the availability of this for these people as being a meaningful way in which to accelerate their path out of abject poverty.
Thanks, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, as discussion on the financial report is now complete, I'll now move on to the formal part of the meeting. No, if you're not, I'm sorry, Mrs. Llewellyn, but if you've got a further question, I'm happy to take it. But the queue, yeah, we went on the queue.
Legitimate Gomeroi elders. Now, certain Gomeroi elders, have self-selected not to work with us. That doesn't mean the people who remain are not legitimate Gomeroi elders. Now, this does navigate into a very vexed set of areas where certain Gomeroi elders would assert that they have supremacy in terms of their knowledge of the area. Now, I think that's not an area where we want to go as an organisation. We just need to assure ourselves that we have the door open to all to participate in those processes, and we certainly have done that. Certain elements have self-selected not to participate, but again, these are complex areas of a community which often has different views amongst themselves, let alone views expressed towards Whitehaven. But we certainly have an open door to working with all. But as you say, we would not accept, and do not, the use of cultural knowledge that is not relative to the land in which we're operating as being in any way legitimate to verify the existence or otherwise of something cultural on the area where we're working.
Paul, have a discussion.
Look, I think certainly the Canadian plan is the first commercialised one which we've seen. Quite frankly, my belief is that China will actually make the biggest strides, and they are already with development plans. Not as almost finished as the Canadian one is in terms of actual construction, but just given the size of the market there, the size of the generation fleet, and quite frankly their ability to fund the commercialisation of this technology, I wholly expect that they will be the first ones to actually bring it to the wholesale market. And the technology itself is actually not unique, as you may well know. I mean, the oil and gas industry has been using sequestration for a long time. So that technology is not it. It is all about finding the right location for the power station so that you can find the right area in which to retain the liquefied CO2. So, but I do expect this will be, in the very short term, we'll see the experience out of the Canadian example. And China is also bringing on a couple of plants itself.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Look, I'll take one more question in this part of the meeting before we move on to the formal resolutions. I've got Steve Talbot has requested to ask a question. Shareholder Steve Talbot.
I'd like to turn out the question
to the questions are to the member.
I'd like to turn out the question to the shareholder. It comes from a meeting with us. We'll put a PowerPoint presentation
there.
Okay. The elders come from other areas. They are Gomeroi, so it's more responsibility.
I'll take that question on notice with regard to the meeting of shareholders in the local Indigenous community. Okay, thanks Steve. Thanks ladies and gentlemen. That concludes the discussion on the financial reports. Now moving on to the more formal part of the meeting. Today the meeting is considering resolutions to adopt, firstly, the remuneration report, to approve the grant of performance rights to the Managing Director, Paul Flynn, under the company's equity incentive plan, and to elect two members of your board. So the first resolution that we're dealing with to be considered is the adoption of the remuneration report for the year ended the 30th of June 2004. This is a non-binding advisory resolution. Before opening this item to questions and discussions, I wish to make some brief comments to assist shareholders in understanding Whitehaven's approach to remuneration. During the year, we continued to effect the refreshed remuneration framework that was introduced in 2012 following the merger with Aston Resources to ensure that it is consistent with market practice and to enable the company to hire, retain and motivate the best people whilst being aligned with the interests of shareholders. As part of our process of continuous improvement in response to feedback received from shareholders, the board is introducing an additional performance condition to apply for a long-term incentive in 2015 based on achieving defined long-term cost targets. The long-term incentive will also continue to be tested against the total shareholder return performance condition. So that means there's actually going to be two hurdles for LTI vesting. One total shareholder return, one cost target. Unfortunately, there were a number of challenging events over the year which resulted in a disappointing share price performance. In this context, the board determined not to increase remuneration levels for 2015, subject to one exception. In addition, none of the executive's long-term incentives vested this year. and there was reduced vesting of the short-term incentive. This emphasises the link between executive remuneration and the performance of the company, ultimately ensuring that the executive leadership team strives to obtain better results for shareholders, and those interests are aligned. Now, the screen should show. The screen should show details of the proxies received on this resolution. There they are. So they're the proxies that are in. The adoption of the remuneration report is now open for discussion. Are there any questions or comments?
Switch back.
Oh, what happened? Yeah. Technology failure. Is that it? No. For resolution one, please, people.
I don't know. What's your...
So, just use the queuing system for any questions on this resolution. Any further? Now. Oh, hang on. Voting or to speak? Yeah, we'll open the voting in a second. I'm just asking if there's no questions, we'll go straight to the voting. So if there are no questions, we'll call for a vote. So those with a handset to vote, press the button now. It's necessary. Is it right to go? Okay. Oh, yep. Voting's happening. I'll just search here.
So you've just got two things to switch between. For us, I'll just give you a thumbs up on the window, okay?
Yeah, just send me the window.
Whatever. Every time.
Just gotta wait a moment to the machine. Okay. Voting is completed, so everyone who has entered their selection has now voted. So I now declare that voting on this item is closed, so that the result of the poll now appears on the screen. The results show that the resolution has been passed. Thank you. And we will now move on to the second item on the agenda for resolution number two, which is the grant of rights to Managing Director under Equity Incentive Plan. Resolution 2 concerns the grant of performance rights to Managing Director Paul Flynn. This grant reflects Mr. Flynn's LTI award for 2015 as in accordance with his employment agreement. Further details of this LTI grant are set out in the notice of meeting. In summary, the LTI award will be subject to two performance hurdles. The first hurdle is a tabled shareholder return performance condition which will apply to 60% of the award. This condition measures the growth in share price together with the value of dividends reinvested during the period. These rights will be divided into two equal tranches and tested based on performance periods of 3 and 4 years, respectively. Full vesting will only occur if the company's TSR, that is total shareholder return, reaches at least the 75th percentile measured against a peer group of companies. Further, if the company's TSR is below the 50th percentile, no vesting of these rights will occur. The second hurdle, just introduced this year, is a defined cost per tonne target, which will apply to 40% of the award. Testing will occur at the end of the financial year 2017, based on average costs achieved on a company-wide basis over the period from the 1st of July 2016 to the 30th of June 2017. Full vesting will only occur if the board is satisfied that performance meets or exceeds the stretch target. No vesting will occur if the performance is below target of the rights which vest. 50% will be immediately delivered in shares and the remaining 50% will continue on foot subject to a further 1 year service condition. Now the screen shows details of the proxies received on this resolution. The approval of the grant of rights to Mr. Flynn is now open for discussion. Are there any questions? If there are no questions... Oh, sorry, yes. This is a Mr. Smith's question. You hit the question button on the back.
Yep. I have to hold the I won't hold the papers as well. I would like to see included in the way that you determine the remuneration for the CEO something that is probably going to be a bit different from what companies do generally, but that the words are hard to find, but that where Paul or whoever's the CEO undertakes some of the sorts of interaction that I had when I was in the Tyfield TAFE. I was one of two that arrived at the course that wasn't claiming Aboriginal heritage. I said, as far as I know, but, you know, four generations over the Blue Mountains, who knows? And the other person was a male nurse who wanted to understand his patient. Unfortunately, he didn't learn to protect himself, and he got sick and he left, which left me the one person standing. And I wasn't getting real positive feedback from my teacher, a very capable Aboriginal woman from Foster, who had been 30 years in Aboriginal education, and I was just lucky that a male Aboriginal knocked her off her post as director of the Wallatooka Newcastle Aboriginal Studies Unit. So I had her over at the TAFE. She was wanting part-time work. She was healing her son of leukemia. And I will now get to the suggestion that that woman, she listened to the mob. She did not want me in that class. But when somebody from up the back of the room, a woman that would have had to do something that most women hope they'd never have to do to survive financially, she said, "While you're in this room with us, you're one of us." And from that day forward, that teacher accepted me. Today, she is a mentor to me. The only teacher that ever gave the private phone number. She will not socialise with me. I am white trash. She will educate me. I can go by, and if her car is in the carport, we have a cuppa, we have a yarn. She never lets me off the hook easily. And I would say to anybody who has the opportunity to interact with people like that, that it would be well worth your while. And if it was reflected in your remuneration package, that would be, for me, the shareholder, some sort of to hang on to, that it's not just tokenism. Thank you.
Thank you for your suggestion. We'll note that and take that on board. Just one word of response. This resolution is about long-term incentive. Part of one of the KPIs, just to inform you, one of the KPIs for the senior management team, short-term incentives, is a broader, and I know it's a generic term, but a broader stakeholder engagement piece that does include the engagement of the Indigenous community as part of that overall KPI, but in the short-term incentives. But we'll take on board your comments. Okay, thanks. I don't have any other questions, so we will move now to the voting on the second resolution. So voting is open, so everybody can please use their electronic devices to vote. Yep, it's open, so away you go. Okay, Tim advised me that voting is now concluded, so you will see the result of the total vote, the votes that we've received in those cast today there, and the screen shows that as proxies, and we declare that that resolution as having been carried. Thank you very much. It passed. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as the next resolution relates to my re-election, I now propose to hand over the control of the meeting for resolution number 3 to the Deputy Chairman, Mr. John Conde. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next item of business is Mark Vale's election as a director. He was appointed as an independent director of Whitehaven and chairman of the board in May 2012, following the merger with Ascot Resources, and in accordance with the requirements of the Constitution and listing rules, Mark offers himself for election. His qualifications and experience are set out in the notice of meeting, and as indicated in the notice of meeting, Mark is standing for election as an independent director. At this point, I'd invite Mark to comment briefly about himself.
I won't take the time of the meeting, but just for those of you that, that don't know me and my background, both in my responsibilities in this company and outside, I've been involved with the previous company, Ashton Resources, from about 2009 through to the merger of Ashton Resources and Whitehaven in May of 2012, which time I took on the responsibility as the chairman of the board of Whitehaven Coal Limited. My broader responsibilities also include non-executive directorships on the board of Virgin Australia and service office provider Servcorp Limited, which is an Australian company with a footprint globally. I also sit on the board of Host Plus Superannuation Fund, which is the superannuation fund service in the hospitality industries in Australia. And I'm on the board of one Singapore listed company that has real estate assets in Australia, Stamford Land Corporation, which owns the chain of Stamford Hotels in Australia. I live just outside of Taree on the mid north coast. I was born there, lived there all my life. Went to school there. Prior to my public life, I had a business with a partner and my wife in the property industry in the Manning Valley. I was involved in the Greater Taree City Council. Just in light of some of the discussions we've had today, grew up and was actively engaged with permanent friends in my local Indigenous community in Taree. It's quite a significant community. So just in response to Joy's comment, that some of us have a very long and deep personal relationship and understanding with the Indigenous community in different areas that we come from. I don't come from the Gunnedah Basin, where I come from over the coast. Being involved in my business and in local government, in 1993 was elected to the federal parliament and had the honour of going on to serve three in industry at the Howard government, holding portfolios of transport, and regional development, agriculture and trade. And some of the experiences from 17 odd years in politics, and particularly in the markets that we talk about in Southeast Asia and North Asia, very, very familiar to me from that role. I did play in government. I left politics in July of 2008 to go back to pursuing a career in the private sector, and that's what led me through to this point with Whitehaven and some of the other businesses that I have. And so that's the background experience I bring to the role as the chairman of the board of Whitehaven, representing the interest of shareholders. Thank you.
We are very fortunate to have Mark as our chairman or the deputy prime minister of the country, and his contacts and his experience are very helpful, very constructive and very caring. The screen should show the proxies received for this resolution. And the matter is open for discussion. We'd be happy to take any questions.
This is Mrs. Llewellyn Smith.
Obviously, the library story, the technology doesn't like, and I said I didn't know machines had a much. I'll hold it so that I get the mic.
You must have the only machine that conveys that message.
I'm sure that the board are very pleased to have the expertise and the networking and knowledge that Mark brings to the board. I think you came to the board via Aston Resources, you mentioned earlier in the meeting today. And so you actually come, when they talked earlier about the purchase of Maules Creek, Whitehaven didn't purchase from Rio, they got it off our unsuccessful millionaire young one.
Let's just get to today.
I will. I'm just saying that I hope that you haven't had any of that rub off on you. That's why I'm raising it. It's relevant. Now, just on a very short piece, for my sins, I'm a student of life and I went to philosophy classes at continuing education at Sydney Uni and at WEA, and that man had come back from finishing a PhD and he studied Wittgenstein and he kept telling us the use of language is very important. So I want the board to tell me why you're not following the pattern that will happen at a meeting I attend in the afternoon today. Why is Mark down as being elected rather than re-elected?
I think that's just the way the he is being re-elected, but the term seems to have faded from use and it's now always elected. Elected, even if it is a re-election. If there be no further questions, I put the resolution set out on the screen and open the poll on this item. So you press your voting button, please.
Okay, we'll go back to the agenda. Resolution number 4 is the election stroke re-election of Christine McLaughlin as a director of Whitehaven Coal Limited. Christine was appointed as an independent director of Whitehaven in May of 2012. In accordance with the requirements of the Constitution and Listing Rules, Christine offers herself for election. Her qualifications and experience are set out in the notice of meeting. As indicated in the notice of meeting, Christine is standing for election as an independent director. I'll hand over to Christine to address the meeting.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you, Chairman, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to address your meeting this morning. It's been a privilege to serve on the Whitehaven board for the last 2.5 years, working on behalf of you, our shareholders, and like you, I am a shareholder in Whitehaven. Since my appointment 2.5 years ago, there's been a lot of change at Whitehaven, as well as in the coal industry more generally. Your board and management have been strongly aligned in the development of Moores Creek project and in commencing operations at the Narrabri Underground. During the last couple of years, our CEO has built great depth and strength in our management team, and it's been a pleasure to work with that team. Many of them are here today. As chairman of Whitehaven's Remuneration Committee for the last 2.5 years, I've overseen changes to the structure of our remuneration program, which has kept Whitehaven up to date with best practice and seeks to align reward with company performance. In that capacity, I've actively met with a number of shareholders in conjunction with our chairman, Mark Vale, and proxy advisors in seeking feedback on our remuneration. I also serve on Whitehaven's Health, Safety, Environment and Community Committee. The safety of our employees is incredibly important. In fact, it's the first matter we discuss at every board meeting, as well as being the focus of that committee. Similarly, we take our obligations to the environment, our responsibilities and to the communities in which we operate very seriously. I won't go into chapter and verse about my upbringing as the chairman has, but I will confirm that similarly, I did grow up and was educated in a small rural community in the Riverina, and community is something that's very important to me personally, it's part of my values. Outside of Whitehaven Coal, my other public company boards include NIB Health Insurance, based in Newcastle, and more recently the Spark Infrastructure Group. I also chair the Australian Payments Council, and I'm active in the charitable sector. For me, it's both a privilege and a responsibility to serve on the board of Whitehaven. If I'm re-elected today, I will welcome the opportunity to continue to work with this management team and with this board and represent you, our shareholders. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Christine. As you can see, we have a highly skilled, very diverse set of backgrounds and experience on our board, and there's no doubt that Christine has brought a significant amount of rigour to our processes of remuneration, as has been attested to by all proxy advisors and boards, and that has been a responsibility that Christine's taken on with our independent remuneration advisors and the other members of the committee in as we've structured that going forward, and to the point where, as you saw, we've received significant support for the remuneration. So thank you for all that work you've done in that regard, Christine. So the screen shows the details of the proxies received. Are there any questions now? Jeff Orrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Board. I'm here today representing 25 members of the Australian Shareholders Association, and I'm voting 250,000 shares. It's been a fascinating morning. I'd just like to come down to earth a little bit, and I'd like to make a comment that I'm always pleased, and I think shareholders also, pleased when they see a row of little green flashing lights across the front tape, because what that means is that directors have got the same skin in the game as we do as shareholders. Chairman, I just wanted to ask if you could inform the meeting of any moves to have a policy on directors holding shares. I know you're a substantial shareholder yourself, and also know Ms. Christine McLaughlin is also a shareholder. I'm wondering if you do have a policy or have any thoughts of a policy that perhaps directors might show significant confidence in the future of the company with maybe holding, say, a year's fees in shares.
Thanks, Jeff, and I recognise that that's broadly policy of
the ASA, and we have had this discussion before, and I think I can comfortably say that, that all directors are currently shareholders in the company, some holding much larger shareholdings than others, but nonetheless, it's all relative and it's very, very important. And the sentiment of your question then, the policy with regard to board members holding shares, I think is a very valid one. No, we don't have a codified policy on directors being shareholders. We certainly do very openly encourage that, and as you can see, this board, as it's currently constituted, started in May of 2012. And in that time, those board members that came on that didn't have a shareholding have very quickly aggregated a relatively significant shareholding. We, as we have done in private discussion before, we take on board your suggestion to, in terms of a company policy on that. But I suppose what I'm saying is we basically have that in practice, if not in terms of a codified policy. Joy, if I can call you Joy.
I'm known as Joy. Most people don't even know my surname, but you had the privilege of having it on the machine. And I've worked out what the problem was. I would press to go in the queue, and then the little thing would highlight saying, leave the queue. And I'm thinking, no, I'm still in the queue. So I press the button and it's taken off. Okay, so talking about shareholding of directors, yeah, I'd really like to say that I do follow the share price, and I noticed that one of the directors, and I won't use the gender, so then it won't identify anybody, and it wasn't female. Oh, I'm funny. One of the directors obviously thought that, you know, they had other things to do in life, and I think it was either $2 million or 2 million shares, and I think it might have been 2 million shares. In hindsight, like, that's published information. I should have followed suit, because, you know, then it went back down again, and I'm still holding the ones I bought at $5.50. So, the next bit is, I really found, Christine, your presentation very sincere, and it left me with a dilemma, because you're supportive of a board that's doing things that sometimes I just can't get my head around. So you maybe have more inside information. So what I'm going to suggest is that you encourage your fellow directors to recommend that Whitehaven Coal erect at Maules Creek a monument, a very nice, stylish monument, to the habitat and the wildlife that had to be let go in the wider interest of mining this high-grade coal. Thank you.
Thanks, Joy. I'm sure Christine will take that suggestion on board. She doesn't need too much encouragement to make her thoughts known to the board. Just on your earlier reflection on directors trading, just so you know, there are really only two windows of opportunity for directors to trade after the announcement of full year results and half yearly results. And so that really does restrict whatever the personal circumstances are for individual shareholders, and directors must have the same rights as other shareholders in terms of being able to buy or sell stock, but they are restricted to those two windows. And so that's the, you know, that's one of the disciplines, I suppose. Or the flip side of the discipline, I mean, you know, Jeff's point is about, you know, directors having skin in the game, so they share the same pain as shareholders, and the same upside, have the same aspirations, and their expectations are aligned. The flip side for directors is that they are very narrowly defined windows that they can trade. Thanks. Okay, I've got one further question from Graham Brophy.
just a comment, if I may.
Sure.
I'm really impressed to see in Christine's CV the experience in the nuclear industry. I think there's no greater source of energy than coal. So there's only one greater source of energy than coal, and that's nuclear. And it's good to have you on the board of experience. Thanks.
Thanks, Graham. If there are no further questions, then I will open the matter for voting. So we've got it open, there it is, and so if everybody could use their electronic devices to cast their votes on resolution number 4, the re-election. Interesting. So voting is underway. So voting is closed and the results of the poll are on the screen, and I now declare the result of the poll as the resolution has been passed, and congratulate Christine on her re-election to the board, and also congratulate Christine on topping the poll. Well done. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the formal business to be determined at this meeting. I would like to now formally declare the meeting closed. I'm sure there's a cup of tea still available outside for those that want to stay and have a cup of tea and mingle or have any discussion with any members of the board. We'll be here and available for some time. Initially, Paul Finn and I have got to do a media commitment first, but we will be around having a cup of tea after that, and happy to have a discussion with everybody. And again, please take the opportunity to join with all the directors for that cup of tea being served in the foyer. And thank you all very much for your attendance today. Thank you.